This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 5, Episode 18, How to Stop Cramps. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we discuss the problem of cramps and how to stop them if you have to retire your innings due to that issue. We also talk about assessing the value of a wicketkeeper. And we have a question from a young bowler who's managed to grow so quickly he's lost his action. How can we help him? Listen in and find out. All that and more coming up on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, your guide to coaching and playing cricket. Audio goodness every week that is available to you no matter what your ambitions are in the world of cricket. My name is David Hinchliffe, and joining me live from a match where he's trying to do about five things at once, which is an impressive skill, it's Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School, Mark Garraway. Welcome, Garras.
Welcome. Thank you very much for having me. And if I do one of those five things half decently, I'll be quite impressed.
It's a juggling act to be impressed by. somebody who has got total focus on the podcast though this week, the man in charge of cricket at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's at Sam Lavery. Welcome, Lavers.
How are we? Everyone okay?
Very good, thank you. Yes, not so echoey today. You've lost a little bit of gravitas in your voice.
No, back to a conventional room rather than a hall.
Yeah. All right. Okay. And someone also who's come down a little bit from last week. Last we heard he was at the top of the pavilion at Lord's, but this week, Berners, we don't know where you are. So, Berners, what's happening? Where are you?
I'm very good. Just in West London, but I was at Lord's yesterday. We got a new recruit, so I was just taking him through some of the systems we use there, Chris Watling, and hopefully we're going to hear from him on the podcast at some stage. So, all good. Garras, do the boys at your school actually do anything other than play cricket?
It's a very good question. There are a couple of exams kicking around, and we've had to make a couple of changes, which has given opportunity to others. But going back to your original question, we play quite a lot of cricket. It would be fair to say that.
Well, you know, if you've got a bunch of schoolboys knocking about in the afternoon, what you don't want to do is leave them to their own devices, do you?
Exactly. Keep them entertained.
Yeah, so that's good for trouble. Speaking of schoolboys, we've got some follow-up this week. A few weeks ago, we had a chap called Richard get in touch with us regarding his son. I don't know if you remember this. His son is a youngster who was 7 years old at the time. I don't know how old he is now, but he was training with the 11 to 13 year old age group, and you know, what kind of help could we give him when we were looking at a talented player and sort of how to guide him and all that kind of thing. Well, he's sent me a message via Facebook just to give us some follow up, so I'm going to read that and let you know the follow up to that story. Richard says, as promised, I'll keep you updated with my 7 year old son progress at Lancashire. On Saturday, Lancashire merged the two 7 to 9 and 10 to 13 groups together. Then they split the group into four smaller groups for fun and team building sessions. The coaches had been analysing the youngsters over the last 3 months on how they played. When they handed out certificates on Saturday, only one boy received gold, four received silver, and all the rest got bronze. My son was one of the ones who received silver, and no other child out of the younger group got silver. He's the youngest there by quite a margin. So it sounds like he's done a pretty good job of coming forward, especially with older kids.
It's good exposure. I think there's always a place to play at your own level, and sometimes a good skill to do is learn to dominate your own level of cricket sometimes. So rather than constantly pushing yourself above your level to try and be challenged all the time, it's good to also go out and dominate. But I think a blend of the two is really, really useful.
Yeah, I suppose you've got the risk of the big fish syndrome of, you know, settling in into a level where you're comfortable as well. So you have to be careful of that, though, don't you, Garris?
You do, and I completely agree with Sam. You know, a mix of both is really, really important. And as long as when you go into the upper age groups, you learn a few things and then take that back. And I've seen quite a few people that have gone into older age groups or into senior cricket cricket and play a really good brand of cricket and then just forget it when they go back into their own environments and their own age groups. So brilliant exposure. And the next thing is to go back and take all of those learnings and all those experiences back into your own age group, and you can impart that upon others as well as just yourself, which would be a great thing.
Yeah, we had a talented player at my club last year who was probably too good for the age group cricket he was playing in. But the challenge for him was to stay involved in that level of cricket and not feel like it was beneath him to go out and play and score lots of runs. Because you know, there was a couple of innings where it looked like he was just going through the motions a little bit. He'd moved on to bigger and better things, and there is a place for having the commitment to go to that level and go, right, well, I'm just going to go out and score 100 because I know that I can.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing that I think is really important is that when you are a really good player and when you have played a lot of cricket up and you've been successful, when you go back into your own age group, that the wicket that you take out to the middle with you when you bat in particular is one that everybody wants to get. So if you can get into a mode of everybody wants my wicket, and I'm going to do my utmost to dominate them, to score runs and to not let them have it cheaply, I think that's the way to go. And certainly the most successful schoolboy cricketers and the ones that have done the best throughout their career have taken that sort of attitude into any game.
Now, another thing I wanted to mention this week, and I don't know how much time we're going to get to talk about it, so maybe it's just briefly mentioning it this week, but I've been just sort of mulling over the idea of wicketkeepers in my mind, because there was an article this week on Cricket Info talking about how it's the classic thing of, you know, the old-fashioned wicketkeeper who puts wicketkeeping above batting is a vanishing thing. But I was wondering whether there is any way to be objective about wicketkeeping skills, and is there any way to go beyond the, oh well, the ball just melts into his gloves, he's, you know, he's obviously a world-class wicketkeeper. Is there any way to turn that into numbers? Because with batting, obviously with bowling, it's a lot easier to turn those skills into numbers. But is there any way to turn wicketkeeping skills into numbers? How do you do it, Gareth?
Well, we do it on a very simple thing for all of our fielders, actually, because obviously our resources are relatively limited, although more than most, let's be honest. We do it on a run save, runs lost for all fielders and all keepers. So that's as simple as it gets. I know that England do it, particularly in the Lions and the 19s and the 17s. They do it because one of our keepers has been in that setup this winter, and I've had huge amount of stats. So it's offside takes, leg side takes, offside fumbles, leg side fumbles. It's balls coming in from the outfield and all of those sorts of things. And that's fantastic. I really like to have that data. But also, we've got to make sure that we're contextualising everything. So an example would be if I was running the same system that England run, then one of our keepers the other day dived for a row of houses with four needed off one ball, fine leg up in the circle. It flicked the bloke's side pad, he dived down the leg side, he got a hand on it, he palmed it down and it went for two instead of four and we won the game. Yeah, under the stats sheet, it would have been considered to be a fumble and a failure, effectively. So you've got to contextualise everything that you do with stats, and that's the way that England have gone about doing it. And as long as you apply context to it, I'm quite happy. But in my world, which has got to be a bit more simple, then we just go for runs saved and runs lost.
I think that's one of the difficulties, isn't it, that you've got to combine your qualitative and your quantitative analysis together, haven't you, rather than just having one or the other. If you're all qualitative analysis, it's great to have opinions and thoughts on things, but there's no sort of hard evidence to back anything up. And then if you're all stats and numbers only, then it doesn't interpretate the real situation of what's been going on around people, and you can't quantify the pressure situations or various other aspects of the game. So it's combining the two is a difficult thing to do, obviously, but if you can get it right, it becomes really, really beneficial, doesn't it?
It certainly does, and you know, that's one of the challenges. So to me, in our environments that we're generally working in, I think that the more simplistic we can keep it, the better, and the more contextualised we can make it, the better as well. So as I say, we just do run save, runs lost. We don't necessarily do it on an individual basis. We do it across the whole of the team, and at the end of the day, we have a look at where we've been in the plus figures and where we've been in the minus, and then we compare it against the opposition that we played against, because we monitor them as well. It creates competition, it creates awareness, and that sort of thing is what you do. And you can do it with fielders, you can do it with wicketkeepers as well, but to do anything more complicated than that would take a designated person, and then also somebody who's got the skill as a cricket watcher to be able to contextualise the results.
Yeah, and any way that you can try and put any number, no matter how rough, onto something like that, is going to help, because of notoriously our minds skew towards the extremes of things, you know, and the timing of things. If somebody makes a mistake towards the end of a game, you're more likely to think that player isn't as good a wicketkeeper as person B, who wasn't playing, and therefore stays exactly the same in your estimation, while wicketkeeper A goes down in your estimation because they made a mistake towards the end of the game, and vice versa. If they do something brilliant towards the end of a game, you think they're a better wicketkeeper. So if any way you can get some kind of objective measure on, it's definitely going to help things, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's as you said,
and the only thing I would add to that is that it's really important that you then, if you're going to create these stats, that they're going to add some value. And it's always a challenge, isn't it, in any context, any coaching context, that we end up not having enough time to be able to follow up on these things. And I know that Sam does create the time to do it, but I would encourage people to really get their stats in order with how much time they then got to follow up and make those stats and those findings out useful.
I think that's right. I hear of a lot of people who do take stats and they don't do a great deal with them, and it's almost half the job, which ends up being you may as well not have done it in the first place, really. But I'm quite lucky that I can give a stat sheet to my wicketkeeper, and he can look at it straight away, and he can know what he's going to do in training. If he's clanged four to his left hand from a right hander over the wicket or whatever, he knows where he's going wrong. If he's missing diving opportunities to his left or his right, then he knows where he's going wrong. So there's not a lot of interpretation that's needed with those ones, because the wicketkeeping ones for me are quite simplistic. Some of the ones I've got for batting and bowling are a little bit more complicated, and I've got to turn them into something that's eligible, legible, but something else with the batting is quite simple. So it's just working out what I can use, what I can't use, what can be passed straight on, and what needs a little bit of interpretation for the players you're working with.
All right, let's wrap this up with the yes-no round. Three questions that we can only answer yes or no to, no matter how much more we might want to say about that particular subject. So, Berners, you're back in the game.
I'm back in the game. I'm in the ring. The first question this week is, far more wickets are taken by batsman error rather than bowler's skill.
Yes.
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 Second question, batsmen have to adapt to conditions much more than bowlers.
No.
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 Third and final question, Duckworth Lewis only works for 50 over cricket.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
Okay, it's time for us to delve into the mailbag. A couple of questions which are read out each week, and the best question not only gets answered by the team, of course, but they win a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com, and you can email your questions into us on coach@pitchvision.com. So a couple of questions. We got one guy who is who's emailed back in, and Berners, you've got the details about that, haven't you?
I do. The first question's coming from Tom, and he's had a bit of a growth stint. He's saying that he's got a fairly successful action. However, this season he's grown substantially. He reckons he's grown about 8 inches, and he's now struggling with line and length. So he's just trying to rediscover this in his action. And he said that he's been having a look at his action, and in the bound of his action, he's rather high. So his question is, if he was to now lower this and, you know, become more effective with it being longer, would this help with the transition of energy into his action? So he's got big and he wants to know what to do.
I think it sounds like he's probably quite a smart cricketer already by the look of it. I mean, he knows what he could do, and he knows what he's able to do now. He's identified an area that's potentially changed, which is great. One of the things that I know friend of the show Ian Pont talks about is trying to make your run up three times as long as it is high. And I think Ian actually talks about being at least three times as long as it is high from memory. But that's a really good indicator of how well your energy is transferring towards your target. How high are you jumping? How long are you jumping? Well, obviously, we want forwards momentum as much as we can. We want forwards, backwards motion rather than up and down motion. And if he's jumping up higher and he's got more up and down movement in his action rather than forwards and backwards, then ultimately he's going to carry less momentum to his target and there's a bigger opportunity for it to divert in another direction. The other thing you may find is that the more elevation you get, the more opportunity there is to fall away in your action as well, because jumping up usually involves up and down motion with the arms again, and the downward motion of the arms can lead to that lateral flexion that we talk about most weeks when it comes to a bowling question, which can obviously lead to injury, but also inconsistency in what you're producing. So I would say go back to thinking about moving forwards towards your target. So we're running and jumping and then pushing and extending forwards towards your target, rather than having too much height.
Gareth, what do you think?
Sam's covered all the technical points there brilliantly, and all incredibly valid and exactly what I would do as well. So that's that bit covered. I think the challenge, I suppose, now really for anybody who's grown 8 inches in a short space of time is they've obviously reached their peak height velocity. So during everybody's lifetime, there is a period of time where you grow at a rapid and accelerated rate. And we need to make some allowances and build some patience in whenever we're dealing with any children that are going through that as well. So that's as coaches, that's as parents, that's as also as the person themselves going through it. But it does provide us with opportunities in order to attack as well. So one of the things that we can do in peak height velocity is really build up the aerobic capacity of somebody's system. Because their limb lengths are changing, it's not always easy to deliver technical aspects of the game and expect them to stick, because every day their limb length is changing a little bit, which is obviously going to affect their levels of coordination. So getting highly technical during that phase isn't always the best option. Applying patience and building up other aspects of it is really important. And somebody like Chris Tremlett went through this at a similar sort of age and grew hugely. And the first thing I did was get him in the gym, get him doing loads of rowing, get him doing loads of cycling, get him doing loads of running, but also take an emphasis off of his technical development as a bowler as well, and start working at things like his fielding and his catching and his understanding of diet and things like that that were seen as a really good thing to do in this phase. So that would be my advice. Be patient. Look at the things that you can really capitalize upon in this phase, rather than getting too overly technical or expecting somebody to be able to adapt and hold on to their technique when their limb lengths are changing so significantly.
Okay, well, Tom, hopefully that's helped.
Next question is from Narayan. Next question's from Narayan, and he's a batsman, and he's saying that on the weekend he was batting, and he suddenly had to retire due to cramp in his hamstring. And he goes through much rigorous warm-up and cool down after the game. And he's just asking what he can do and what are the reasons behind getting this and what he can do to avoid getting them.
Cramp's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it affects different people in different ways. You can have 10 people training exactly the same way, and one will get cramps no matter what they do, and another one will never get cramps no matter what they do. So it's a difficult one to manage, isn't it?
It is a difficult one to manage, and having been on tour quite a lot and watching that happen, it is tough. Because I can remember OS Shah in an ODI match cramping up and having to do exactly the same, come off the field. And he was in terrible shape, and his dehydration levels or his levels of hydration were so poor that we had to get him on a drip to get him back into, being healthy, I suppose. And then being able to go out back out and bat a bit later on. And that's an extreme case. But one of the things that I think is crucial is when we're taking on fluid, it's how much we take on, also having an awareness of how much we're taking on. Weighing ourselves at a regular basis throughout the game, I think, is really important, because it gives you an understanding of how much we actually lose as a result of sweating. And it's often those days where it isn't absolutely blistering hot, where we do lose water, we don't hydrate because we don't think we need to, and all of a sudden we find out that we're a kilo and a half down on our starting weight, and the impact on our physical performance and our cognitive performance is actually quite significant. And it's something that we've been doing a lot of this year, is we've been getting people to weigh themselves at the start of the day, at halfway through the day, and also at the end. And we're beginning to get a field of evidence, which is very individualized, as David says, but is enabling us to build in some strategies around people's hydrations pre-performance and after the game, which enables them to hopefully get their levels under control and be able to perform and not suffer from things like cramps that we're talking about here.
Well, cramping's quite a tricky subject. A number of different areas that have been put forward that have been proposed to reduce cramping or prevent cramping, but none of them have been proven to work categorically. However, two or three of them have been proven to have noticeable impact. So the ones that have been proven to actually have an impact positively, but they won't conclusively remove cramping completely, are stretching is one of them. So that's not just stretching during a game or stretching when the cramping ensues. It's more stretching 2 to 3 times a day. Opposing muscle to the muscle that is cramping up, but trying to do that 2-3 times a day is a regular thing throughout the season and hopefully throughout the year. So stretching is a key thing, and it's something that needs to be incorporated.
And are we talking about static stretching there,
static stretching really, because it's something we'd be looking to do 2-3 times a day, and where we'd probably stretch the muscle concerned initially. So if it was a hamstring, we might do a basic hamstring stretch. Obviously we're not going to push it too hard, because we're not looking to overwork the muscle when it's maybe not completely prepared for a long stretch. But a basic stretch of the muscle and the muscle group around it. So if we were stretching our hamstring because it was the muscle concerned, then we'd also do the quad, we'd also do the calf, we'd also stretch the back as well. So that's been proven to have positive impact, although, as I said before, it's not a conclusive method that will prevent cramps. Hydration is one thing that is always included, and it's something that is, again, something that will have a positive effect on cramp, but it won't necessarily remove the instance of cramp occurring in the same way as stretching. So hydration is vital, because cramping is essentially is the electrical signal being sent to the muscle not working correctly. And if your fluid levels are low, or your hydration levels are low, then these electrical signals can't be passed as quickly or as efficiently or as reliably. So by making sure that we are hydrated, those electrical signals can move from the brain to the relevant muscle and be a little bit more effective and a bit more reliable. Similarly, the electrolytes within the muscle work in a similar manner as part of that process. So maintaining them is key. So what we've got to look to do is try and maintain hydration levels, try and maintain electrolyte levels. As Gareth mentioned earlier on, now obviously we've got to think about what can cover as many boxes as possible. Most sports drinks you'll see these days will have a element of electrolyte. They'll have a hydration being water based, but they'll also be carbohydrate based as well. And the reason for the carbohydrate largely is so that the body identifies it as something that it really, really wants, because it's usually the priority is energy over hydration for the body. So spot some energy source, says I'm going to have that, and in having that I'm going to be holding on to this water for the period of time that I'm taking the energy away from it. So that in turn adds to the our hydration level and adds to our electrolyte level, which is going to prepare us slightly better for the performance or the continued performance that's going on. So trying to think out of practice or out of match situations, trying to stretch and be hydrated as much as we can, but also making sure that continues throughout performance as much as possible. The key thing is, it's still to a degree quite a grey area, I think, in modern science, where lots of lots of areas of modern science are quite black and white, and there are definitive answers of what we must do and what we can do to try and prevent things. But with cramps, it's still something that hits even the top performers in the world. Mm. And as Gareth alluded to, OHR's had problems, and Michael Carberry's very famously had a lot of problems as well over the years, which he seems to have got under control now. But one of the key factors is always hydration levels. So I would always try and be as thoughtful as possible in preparing and maintaining that hydration level throughout any match.
So test, experiment, retest, keep that loop going until you find the thing that works best for you, and know that there may never be a perfect solution.
Yeah, I think people will suggest to take journals of your dietary intake, take journals of your hydration status, and it sounds very nice, but people often will think, oh, that's a good idea, but will they follow through and do it? And that's just trying to do that for maybe a month and seeing how that affects how you perform, and just trying to keep a little log of what you do and don't eat, what you do drink, and see how it affects. And if you can find something that works for you, then you're suddenly you could be set up for a cramp free season ahead, which no doubt for a lot of people who have serious problems with it would be a great thing.
It's time now, David, to get up onto the soapbox to clamber up and to rant and rave for a minute.
I want to talk about something that happened in a training session. A bunch of young players that we had in a training session, and we were doing some work, a little bit of batting work, a little bit of fielding work. So the guys had to field while a pair of batsmen batted, and that's quite close to a game of cricket, I would say. One of the players was not enjoying it very much, and he got so frustrated with the fact that the ball wasn't coming to him very often, despite our efforts to move players around and get the ball to as many people as possible, that he said to me, this is really boring, I'm really not enjoying this practice. And I said to him, well, what's the difference between what you do in a match when you're fielding and this? And he couldn't give me the answer. And I said, the only difference, as far as I'm concerned, is in your head. If you practice like you play, in fact, if you practice a little bit harder than you play, then you might find that when you get out into the middle, you find that playing becomes a bit easier. So if you hunker down in that practice, and when you think, oh, this is getting a bit boring, remember that boring stuff that you're doing might make a difference to your game when you're out in the middle. So keep doing it. And that is the end of the show for this week. But don't go away yet. We've just got a couple of more things that we need to chat to you about before we head off. The first of which is we need to decide on a winner of this week's competition. The prize, the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So we had Tom's question about his bowling action and growing quickly. And we had Ryan's question about cramps. Gareth, which one did you prefer this week?
Well, I'm going to go for the Rhines, but what a great question from Tom as well. I thought it was awesome. But yeah, the Rhines one, it's a first for us, talking about different levels of hydration and how we can get through cramps, and some brilliant advice from Sam. So as always, the question gets rated by the quality of the answers, I suppose. So this time it's the Rhine.
Fantastic. Congratulations to you. You win that prize, and you can pick anything you like from the list at pitchvision.com. Now, Berners, if somebody wanted to send in their question, perhaps win a prize, and certainly get that question answered on the show, what would they need to do?
You can give us a call on 020-323-97543, or drop us an email, and we'd love to hear from you.
Yep, it's coach@pitchvision.com, of course. You can also tweet us at pitchvisionacad. You can find everyone else's Twitter accounts around there as well. And you can join in on our Facebook page, our million views Facebook page. If you listened last week, you know what that's about. And in fact, we're coming up to the 34,000 like mark on that page as well. Facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. So join in the fun there if you're a Facebook type person. You can also listen to the show every week. You can subscribe in iTunes if you're an Apple type person. You can do that by doing a search for Pitch Vision Academy. And if you use any other podcatching program on your phone, on your computer, or wherever you've got it, your tablet, then head over to pitchvision.com/academy, click on the podcast link, and you can find the details for subscribing in whatever player that you fancy. And that's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Garrers. Cheers, Labours. Cheers, Burners.
Cheers, boys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks very much, guys. Speak to you soon.